Welcome to Open Rights Group Sheffield. Tonight we've got Jim, the director of ORG, speaking on surveillance, liberty and activism.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back here in Sheffield. Been a few times, occasionally to sort of turn up when Nick Clegg and co are doing their bit, and a few times on bits of training and other meetings with ORG Sheffield. Today I'm going to be talking about mass surveillance, how that interacts with liberty and what we do about it. Is mass surveillance okay? Do we just put up with it? What is its effect? What are we going to do about it? So I should just say who I am as well before we crack on. So I'm Jim Killock. Been executive director of the Open Rights Group for about 5 years now. Before that, I worked in activism, green politics, things like that. But I've also worked in digital startup, so I've done web design and tinkered around with Linux, all those sorts of things. Got into information politics through that, through seeing what open source does for people and how that is an empowering thing. That said, I'm working on a Mac laptop today, which has been defeated, and we're using Debian. So that's all good. So what about the Open Rights Group? So the Open Rights Group was founded nearly 10 years ago at a meeting in May 2005. There was a meeting. Cory Doctorow and other people said, where is the British version of the Electronic Frontier Foundation? Who is it who's going to fight for digital rights in the UK? The big issue at the time was Labour pushing ID cards. They were pushing identity cards and saying, you know, we need to know who everyone is all of the time to make sure that everybody isn't a terrorist. Because that's the way you should do rights, isn't it? So that's what they were proposing at the time, and people were outraged by this. They were outraged by the simplicity, the lack of technical knowledge. Not just that the people didn't understand the technology, but they didn't understand the implications of what they were saying. That just because you have data, that doesn't mean that it's okay to lump it all together. And if you put everybody into a single database, that has an effect on people's liberty and their rights and their relationship between the citizen and state. So you have to sort of understand a little bit about what the technology enables in order to understand the implications. And they felt that we needed to be a technology group that would help explain some of this to politicians. So on to what we're talking about today. So mass surveillance, GCHQ, what they're up to, what we've learnt from Snowden. We want to understand a little bit about what mass surveillance is in this context and whether it targets you, whether this is, as the politicians claim, whether this is about just finding terrorists or whether it inevitably is actually about whole population surveillance. And this is quite a live debate. And if we're right that it is actually targeting everybody rather than just suspects, what then does it do to liberty? What does it do to our freedoms? Does it in fact destroy it? And if it does undermine our liberty, what do we do about that? So let's just take a bit of a step back. As I think the first thing, you know, just regarding this change, I think it's just worth considering what the difference between, if you like, digital mass surveillance is from traditional surveillance. And also just think a little bit about how we've ended up here. Because, you know, we have this traditional idea about spies, you know, human intelligence, investigating people, bugging their homes perhaps, breaking in, doing bad things, but in the name of defending us against, for instance, the communist menace. But there is actually a backstory to, I think, the last 100-odd years of surveillance, which is this history, if you like, of signals intelligence, SIGINT, as they say in the trade. SIGINT, or signals intelligence, is about capturing information that is travelling essentially electronically. So once you have the telegraph in the 1800s and then the telephone after that, you have this source of information that is generally sent in the clear that you can start scooping up. And the UK, of course, was at the start, you know, it was the hub for the telecommunications network for cable selling telegrams. And in fact, that network is what we now know in a lot of cases, that the cable network is pretty much the network which has become the internet. At least that's the roots of the cables are pretty much the same across the Atlantic and so on. So Britain's ended up at the hub of that. But anyway, the point I was trying to make was more that electronic surveillance is a kind of easier surveillance than surveillance in the past. So once electronic surveillance exists, you have something which you can capture largely in bulk, read it easily. And that's a lot different, for instance, to, say, the post, where you have to open all of the letters and read all of the letters. It's different from any kind of traditional traditional kind of surveillance and interception. It makes it easier. So by the 70s, they were kind of listening into lots of phone calls, particularly to Eastern Europe, but they still weren't trying to capture absolutely everything. The target tended to be overseas stuff, but the electronics obviously did make it easier. So what happens with digital? Suddenly everything is communicating and everything is producing something which might be of intelligence value. From the perspective of the agencies, one perspective says that they find this a total nightmare. How are we going to monitor all the communications? How are we going to find the things we're really interesting? That's the story they like to tell to politicians. The other side of it is what you see in the NSA's 5-year strategy, the bits that have been published post-Snowden, where they say that this is the golden age of signals intelligence because there's so much of it. Gosh, you know, we've got so much information that we can do. You know, lots and lots of things we can analyze, incredible amounts of information. But of course, all the other factor here, hi there. The other factor there here is that suddenly your television is an internet device. Your phone is, obviously, your computer is. Lots of things that you have traditionally used, you know, even, you know, we find watches and personal devices, you're monitoring your heartbeat, whatever it happens to be, lots of things, your electricity meter, even, all of these things are gathering data and can be surveillance, because everything that is digital, that is creating information, that is potentially recording that information, can be used for surveillance. So the question for us is, if everything can be surveillance, if every digital device potentially is a surveillance device, will everything become surveillance devices? That is the question for us. So let's take another step back. I've got another context question. So why is this push to gather everything? So there's so much information out there. Why then do we have a push from government and the agencies for gathering everything up? Why do they want to do it? So I think there are multiple answers to this. One would be that there are external threats that they're worried about. You know, they're worried about Syria, they're worried about other things which pose external security threats, and they want that information. Another more bland reason is that if you're a politician and there's a terrorist incident and you haven't done everything possible in your power, you're going to feel a little bit responsible and that you can be blamed for not doing everything possible to prevent terrorist deaths. And this is how GCHQ and so on, I think this is how they sell the message to politicians. They say, but minister, do you want to be the minister that didn't give us the powers that meant that people died? Do you want to be answering that question? And of course, the answer is no. I think that might destroy my political career. Let's do whatever you say. That's why the agencies love ministerial warrants, by the way. All the things that permit this surveillance are all things that they put to ministers. The ministers sign them. Minister, you need to sign this. People might die. So that's one reading of why there's this push. But, you know, why did GCHQ think they want all this information? Why do they take the same reading? Well, I think here they have a policy. They you could call this a sort of Donald Rumsfeld school of surveillance. We know there are known knowns, there are known unknowns, and there are unknown unknowns. What are the unknown unknowns? Well, that's where you haven't gathered all the information and therefore haven't looked through all the information to find what's there, and therefore you don't know what the threat is. So on one level, the risk model that GCHQ has is, if we don't have all of the information, we can't quantify the threats, therefore we're at risk, which is essentially the same logic as, Minister, if you haven't granted us all the powers and people die, it'll be your fault. So it's that's why I say it's a shorthand. The GCHQ's risk model is, I think, essentially, we must have all the information or we won't know all the threats. Therefore, let's gather everything. And that's why the policy seems to be know everything, everywhere, all the time. So you have those factors, and then you have this factor that this is suddenly a huge resource. Just blandly, it is just a huge resource. People are building careers. People are selling software. There is this massive digital opportunity. Do you want to be in that new wave of digital technology in the surveillance industry, or do you want to be saying, no, let's do it the traditional way and look old hat and not build your career? Well, again, you can see the institutional pushes that might result in people moving to develop their careers around mass surveillance. And in with that, I think we should just remember that most of the budget for surveillance and the security service is actually eaten up by GCHQ. They get the vast majority of the spending, as far as we know. They don't publish figures, but even back in the 80s and 90s, the end of the 90s, it was something like 80%. And that's before all this stuff happened. So GCHQ and Signals Intelligence has got the lion's share of the budget for a very long time. So what's the political question? So we've looked a little bit at this already, of course, but there is another kind of thing here. When things go wrong, genuinely go wrong, you know, for instance, the sort of two or three atrocities we've had in the last few years, Charlie Hebdo, Denmark, and Fusilier Lee Rigby, in each of these cases, the public does want a response and deserves an answer from politicians. That, in a sense, is their job. Something's gone wrong. The ministers have to explain what's going to be done about it. The logic goes, something must be done. Surveillance is something, therefore we must have surveillance. Now, there's some tautology there. It doesn't really follow, but that's kind of what happens. And again, if you actually unpeel this and look at those incidents, it doesn't even follow from the logic of those incidents, because those incidents were cases where individuals were known to the authorities. They had been on their radar one way or the other for years often, but the human intelligence part of the agency's work were not able to concentrate on those individuals and put them under sufficient directed surveillance to know enough about what they were doing. They slipped off the radar. It wasn't a lack of surveillance and information, electronic information. It was a lack of human intervention in those cases. So would more surveillance really have done anything about those cases? Well, probably not. But just to twist facts, the Intelligence and Security Committee said, well, actually, it's all Facebook's fault. I don't know if you remember that. But despite finding 20 or 30 ways in which the security agencies, in the case of Lee Rigby's killers, had failed to keep those people under tabs and were unable to connect the dots, they did find afterwards that one of the guys who'd done this had been, believe it or not, messaging Al-Qaeda on Facebook from one of his accounts, and these accounts had been repeatedly deleted, because that's what Facebook are asked to do, delete all the terrorism. That's what they do, and they didn't examine these accounts because there are thousands and thousands of people posting all kinds of really, really, I don't know, mad stuff on Facebook. They don't try to look at it all. But the one, it turned out that he'd been saying to somebody in one of these deleted accounts that he wanted to carry out these murders. And of course that meant, as far as the ISC and Malcolm Rifkin were concerned, that actually this was all the fault of Facebook. And therefore we must have some more surveillance. Now, again, you unpick that, you imagine all of these people saying balmy mad things and putting all of that information into GCHQ or MI6's hands, would they actually be able to sort out who was just balmy and who was a real threat? Probably not. There's probably too much material. Again, it's probably too much information. It doesn't necessarily get you where you want. It gives you probably too much to deal with. So it's unfortunate, but, you know, It wasn't Facebook's fault. It was probably far more to do with our capacity to deal with, you know, a large number of very evil people. So, what then has happened with this mass surveillance? What's happened with GCHQ's more greater powers, given that there's been all these pressures one way or another for more surveillance, either technological, in terms of opportunity, or in terms of budgets, or in terms of political necessity? Well, the first part of this is that both the Labour government and the current coalition attempted to hide mass surveillance. That's what they did. They authorised GCHQ's scooping up of internet information through ministerial warrants. They signed off warrants saying, you can harvest all the information that are from the cables as they leave the country and then process it. So essentially they hid mass surveillance behind a legal framework that was not designed to permit mass surveillance, but nevertheless was able to do that, because, you know, they just said you can write, the ministers are allowed to write these very broad warrants to target people overseas. They said, well, the internet information is all flowing overseas, so let's just take it all, because we don't, they're not, it's not UK communications anymore, we can do what we like. So they hid behind the law, and they didn't tell us. And of course the Intelligence and Security Committee, if they did know about this, which seems unlikely, they didn't understand it, and they failed to tell Parliament. So we were denied a democratic debate about whether this scooping up of internet traffic is legitimate or not. So then, now that we know that this is happening, we now get a response that it is... we'll get two responses. One, that it's not really mass surveillance. That it's... And this is kind of tricky. You know, there's some tricky questions here. The claim is that it is not mass surveillance because we essentially... It's the only way we can get at all of the information. If we want to take Andy's communications and he's communicating with dangerous pirates overseas who, you know, might be doing something deeply criminal... the only way that they can get Andy's communications, the argument runs, is to take everything off the internet and then work out which bits belong to Andy Halsall and then record those. And that's tricky, you know, because the amount of data that's flowing is enormous. So how do you target communications in what is essentially an enormous, enormous flow of information? It is tricky. It's not probably impossible, but it is tricky. And the argument runs from the side of GCHQ. That's the only way that we can target communications, is to harvest everything and then decide on the bits. Of course, this isn't really what they're doing. They're buffering this for, they're buffering everything for 3 days that they can collect. And they're taking the metadata and keeping that for 30 days. And what they're doing in that 3 to 30 day period is analysing it, going back, having another go, sifting, finding the stuff that they think might be interesting and recording that, and in the meantime sharing all of it with the USA and the other countries. So I don't really think this argument that it is necessary really runs. But I think also just because it also doesn't run because it's not what they're really doing. You know, they are gathering and sharing huge amounts of information, but I do think there's also a sort of fundamental question. By not having the democratic debate about what might be acceptable and what methods might be acceptable for allowing GCHQ to target criminals, we've been unable to examine what the alternatives really look like. Since this has happened, the Americans have had to, you know, they've had to look at this and they've wrote reports, you know, what are the alternatives to bulk collection? And they think, you know, there are some. You might lose some information, but you probably can do some targeting. It would require a lot of investment. It might require new technologies, but there probably are ways of targeting information a bit more precisely than, well, collect everything and work it out later. So the other question I think that really we have to think about very carefully is what GCHQ are really doing. And here we come on to this argument that GCHQ put to ministers that they need to collect everything in order that they have the haystack in which to look for the needles. This is their argument. If we don't have the haystack, if we don't build the haystack, we don't find the needles. Now, you might kind of think, well, surely that's not really how it works. If you build, the more information you get, the bigger the haystack, the harder actually it might be to find those needles. And I think there is something to that. But there's also another thing to think about here, which is when they say that they're doing this, what they really mean is they are treating us all as risk, calculating all of our risk factors, giving us all profiles, deciding how terroristy we are or how economically interesting we are or whatever the threat that they're interested in, and assigning a score. So the fact that perhaps some of us use encryption, that might be a score. The fact that we communicate with people with dangerous political ideas, that's another score. You know, the fact you visit these circumvention websites, that'll get you another point. And so you're kind of building up a level of threat. And even if that doesn't get to the sort of golden score of 15 or whatever it happens to be, where you suddenly, get examined by a GCHQ operative, well, you might have a score of 5 or 10, you know, who knows. You have been profiled, you have been analysed, and that has to go on constantly just in case you turn out to be a threat, even though you didn't look like one a few minutes ago. So let's move on now. What does this mass surveillance do to us as a society? Firstly, I think we get into the way that this is working at the moment. We are in a very false debate around, you know, security versus liberty. You know, it's the state's security versus your privacy. That's the kind of argument that is made. I think it's important to remember, for most individuals, privacy is part of their security. And when we're talking about internet issues in general, everybody's personal security is in opposition, actually, to some of GCHQ's objectives. If you are secure and you are hard to hack into, that's not actually very convenient for GCHQ, and this is why you get some of them attacking your right to encrypt, saying your encryption's for criminals and we need back doors. It's also why there are programs like Edge Hill and Bull Run to weaken encryption standards and undermine things more, you know, on that level of your personal security tools. That's not a good idea, but it shows you also that this is actually very complicated. There isn't a simple dichotomy between state security and personal liberty. State security is incredibly high, like, say, in East Germany. That does not make people individually more secure. It makes them all insecure in order that the state can maintain its own security. You have to remember that that actually is part of the balance that goes on here. The state wants a lot of security for itself. It may be after making you insecure. So the second question, I mean, the security and the security services and the law, the way that this has been arranged, it seems to me, has undermined the relationship with our democratic institutions. They've evaded scrutiny. The Parliament has shown itself incapable of keeping control of these forces. And if that's the case, how do you really trust any of it? You know, it's really hard. How do you trust our elected representatives to look after our liberty and stop these agencies from going off the rails. It is incredibly hard. And I think it's worth remembering they do go off the rails. You know, sometimes it will be, you know, some personal corruption or abuse, but sometimes it will be political decision making that looks incredibly, incredibly dodgy. For instance, what did the police do when they decided that they were under threat as an institution from people complaining about their lack of investigations and racism? They investigated Doreen Lawrence and to see whether they could prove that she was corrupt. Why did they do that? Because they thought she was a threat. Threat to what? Threat to the police and therefore law and order. That's the way they see these things. Institutions are incredibly bad at seeing outside of themselves and very bad at confusing their own mission with their own survival. And when you've got powers like GCHQ have, that means that they could easily get very, very off the rails and do very, very bad things very quickly. So you have to be incredibly careful. And, you know, I don't want to go through the whole history of Northern Ireland or anything like that, but I think you will find if you look there, there are plenty of things that have gone wrong there that really, you know, do beg a belief. So I don't think we can just assume that the security services are something we should blindly trust. It's just not reasonable. Right. So other things, you know, I guess a lot of you will instinctively know this, and I don't need to explain it too much. But it is when people need their own privacy for things that they need to do for their own freedom's sake. You know, if you are a journalist, you need to talk to sources. You need to know that this is happening in private. If you are a lawyer, you need to know you are able to communicate with your clients, even if they're criminals, to give them the best defense available. It is not reasonable to take these things away from people. Essentially, we all need privacy for autonomy, but also privacy is a public good and is posited in these, you know, is put as forward in these debates as being a private right, you know, something you enjoy your privacy because you don't want to feel uncomfortable under the scrutinizing eye of GCHQ. And of course, when put against national security, that seems a trivial kind of thing to be worried about. But the truth is that we all need privacy so that we can function on the level of business confidentiality, doctor-patient confidentiality, journalistic confidentiality, all of these things. And we enjoy the benefits of those things as a free society. Essentially, privacy is a public good, not just a private good. We need these things to make society function. I'm not going to talk too much about Tempora, but just to say, you know, I think this is a really classic case of how things gone wrong in enabling this mass scooping of internet traffic. I think it shows also some of the problems that we have with the relationship between the UK's GCHQ and the NSA, huge technological data sharing, technological sharing and information sharing, and it's very hard to distinguish between these institutions. It's very hard to know whether Tempora is really about the UK or whether it's about the US's strategic interests. And that's without talking about how individuals in the UK may or may not be protected once their information is being digested and examined by NSA agents. Mentioned encryption. I think it's, again, just worth a quick note. If one of the responses from Snowden has been that companies have started doing more routine encryption, as they always should have been. You know, your email is now encrypted more or less by most companies, more often than not. Facebook do most of their communications securely. A few years ago, they weren't. Yahoo, similarly, just weren't doing any of this, and now they are. So they're all improving their security arrangements. Note their security arrangements. And this is to the disadvantage of GCHQ's mass data swoops. So that's caused a situation where some of the people are looking at this are saying the internet's going dark, this is terrible, we're not able to do what we were doing a few years ago. That's not reasonable. look, it's even worse. Apple are encrypting people's phones. What are we going to do? We can't just snaffle all the data off people's phones when we give them a caution and take them down the police station. So, you know, it's all a bit difficult. And the practices that the agencies have been engaged in, which have basically been because security has been so badly designed, are becoming hard for them. And that's caused this response from policing and other people, David Cameron even, that, well, encryption, you know, surely we should always be able to get around encryption. Surely this isn't something that people should just be able to do. I mean, it is farcical and it is really ignorant, but we also have to recognise that this is it's one of those arguments which is quite difficult, because you're trying to explain to people that this, you know, encryption, it's not something you can take away. But the argument that the police should be able to get into stuff, that's also quite, you know, instinctively people kind of think that's right. And I think that's why Cameron's got himself into the trouble he has. But we have to be really, really hard on this. We need security because we need security. And it isn't up to the government to decide what security we want or desire or need. It's just not their job. So that comes on, I think, nicely to this basic point. And why do we have rights? Well, the reason is that we want limits to the state. We want limits to the state because we want the state not to behave in an arbitrary fashion. And I have to say, a lot of what GCHQ has done, you know, breaking into foreign companies that have done nothing wrong, harvesting everyone's information, whether they're suspects or not, it looks pretty, you know, arbitrary to me. It doesn't feel like something that's constrained by the rule of law. And, you know, the rule of law is really fundamental. It's how we have rights at all. It's how we know that we're not going to get mugged when we go down the street. It's how we know that if we get, you know, arrested, that we've got a reasonable chance that the system will function and we'll be proven innocent. So once you start undermining the rule of law, you're in real, real trouble. Civil liberties, you know, our rights as citizens and our rights as human beings, they are there to make sure that the rule of law works. The rule of law and human rights are kind of intertwined. They're meant to work together so that these things function and the state is not able to behave arbitrarily. Of course, their intellectual developments, the rule of law is kind of the first thing that pops up. If you look in history, you know, whether it's the Romans or Magna Carta, rule of law is kind of the first thing that people demand. You know, make it work, let's understand the rules, let's, you know, set some rules out. And then later we worked out that there were very specific things that we need to guarantee, including privacy and our free speech. And if we don't have those things, then very quickly the rule of law starts getting undermined. Anyway, I'll try and spare you too much of the lecture. I'm just saying, I think what GCHQ are doing is a direct attack on all of this. And it's really, really dangerous from that perspective. It's not just a bad thing. It's corrosive. You know, it spills out. So what happens next? We've got the election coming up. We've seen what has happened with Charlie Hebdo and the reactions there. The European Union is pushing for passenger name records to be shared en masse with the USA. So there are already, you know, we've had Theresa May pushing for the Snoopers Charter, telling us that we can elect the next Conservative government and she'll guarantee us that we'll be more surveilled. That's a winner. So, you know, that's what we're dealing with right now. We've got a lot of pushes for more surveillance. And I think, you know, just, you know, sometimes you think, what on earth? You know, what we've had all this information from Snowden and we've realised that the surveillance state seems to be somewhat out of control. Even if we think some of it's justified, it doesn't feel like it's been properly controlled. And we're being told the answer is more surveillance, that actually as society's in such a dangerous predicament that we need more surveillance. Well, I think the reason we're getting this push partly is it's a defensive reaction. It's the reaction of Theresa May when pushed on this stuff is, well, let's just ask for more, let's push. And you push for more, you demand the Snoopers Charter, and people like us are having to fight off the Snoopers Charter rather than deal with the underlying problem. That's their tactic. So what do we do? So I'm going to give a few suggestions. There's a lot of things that you can do. and some of them are, a lot of them right now have to be focused on the election. Now, I was in another meeting like this and I said, this is what we've got to do. And a whole load of people just said, well, I don't believe in politics. I don't like it. I don't believe that any of this is going to change anything. Well, okay, I get that. It's easy to be very, very cynical about politics. And I don't want to claim that it's going to sort everything out. But they are weak at an election. It's the one time they have to listen to you because they have to start making promises to get your vote. And they're also doubly weak right now because none of them can win an election anymore. They're all fundamentally incapable of getting everyone's support. And they're even more weak for us because people like you will live in, all of us tend to live in places where there are lots of liberal educated people who do technology and politics, and we tend to live in marginal constituencies as a result. So there's a huge kind of convergence between, if you like, the educated part of the population that cares about things like fundamental rights and marginal constituencies, and believe it or not, technologists. All of them seem to be in the same places, whether it's London, Sheffield, Manchester, Brighton, Norwich. You know, I could list them off. It's an amazing kind of convergence, and it does give us some power because it means that in those places we can force the politicians concerned to tell us how they're going to represent our views and opinions, rather than because if they don't, they might not win their elections. So that gives us some power. So things you can do. One thing I would just say, you know, it's a fun and simple thing. If you haven't seen Citizen 4, if you want to get your friends to go and see it, it's a great film. I think, you know, somebody who knows, you know, if you kind of know all of the stuff, you might find it, you know, a little bit sort of like you know a lot of it. But I think it's an incredible story. And I also think it's incredible for people who know a little bit less about it, because it sets out in the first few frames, it has, you know, these American politicians, they're asked, you know, are you engaged in mass surveillance? Are you listening to every, you know, are you reading everyone's emails? No. You're not doing that. It'd be against the law. You have these people denying all this stuff going on. And then you see the, you know, data centers being built. And then you see what Snowden reveals. It's quite incredible. This is that juxtaposition. I think it's a brilliant thing. So, yeah, organizing them, very, very easy. 10 or 15 people. And you can get a screening. Obviously, sign the petition at don'tspyonus.org.uk. Do things like encrypt your own stuff. Contact your candidates, I should say, rather than your MP right now. If you're members of political parties, get involved with the political parties and bring these issues up at meetings. Write your local paper. Right now, election hustings. We should discuss this in a bit of detail once, and I'm done in a second. But, you know, there will be lots of hustings. Go to them and ask questions about this. We'll send org supporters, if you're a member of org, we'll send you a poster. You can put it up in your door and you can invite candidates to knock your door and you can ask them about this. And they'll be delighted, I'm sure. So secondly, yeah, do the security stuff yourself, you know. Do the encryption, learn better security for yourself so that you understand this technology more, you employ it. You make their lives a little bit more difficult, but more importantly, you're able to engage with the problem yourself. That's an empowerment thing, I think. And finally, yeah, join the Open Rights Group. We depend on people like you to do our work. The vast majority of our funding is through individuals. It's how we've got where we've got, and it's how we'll fight the battles to come. Thank you very much. Thank you.